Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Review. Sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on retirement at risk when we come back. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush, in the last election, said that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, or Moses, or God, had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that the real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. The money is not in public business or jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the old covenant contract and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults, and while you're at it, order my free General Law CD package at the same time. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's free. And you can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Then click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of your pension program, your retirement expectations, that dream that you have. All Americans have it. I imagine most people around the world have the same fantasy, a fantasy of we're going to drive around the country for the rest of our lives in a Winnebago, all expenses paid. I know, I would like to do the same thing, and so would you, and so would everybody else. There are a few winners that are going to do just that. Most of us are never going to see that kind of a retirement. And that's what we're discussing here, is this thing of retirement, because Moses lived to be 120 years old and never retired. He was working the day he died. I pray to God that I will never be cursed with the curse of retirement. I know it's kind of wild and off the wall. I'm past the retirement age. I am not drawing Social Security. And I'm not going to draw Social Security. I'm going to stay as far away from Social Security as I can get. I'm going to avoid Social Security like AIDS, herpes, and VD. And as we progress along in this series, I'm going to show you why. It's a criminal activity to start with, but it's worse than that. It's like the pigs of the Okefenokee. Once you become dependent upon this thing called retirement, as long as the whole world works the way it is today, everybody's going to be all right. But when this thing changes, like the pigs of the Okefenokee becoming dependent upon that free corn, there's no survival for those that are dependent. Independence is the only place that survival is going to lurk. Now, we took a look at a guy from Reader's Digest last time by the name of Ed Beltran. He and his wife, Sherry, are retired. They get $4,467 a month. That's $53,604 a year. And he's working for $7.50 an hour to make ends meet. Boys and girls, I would submit to you that more than half of the people of the United States of America don't make $53,604 a year. More than half do not make that kind of money, and this guy's retired. Now, he's not retired to the degree that he desires to be retired. He thought he should have more than $53,000 a year. And Alan Greenspan made an observation back in 1996 talking about people's expectations in the stock market, and he called it irrational exuberance. And as a result of that irrational exuberance, Americans, 100 million of them, invested in the stock market in the 1990s, and combined they lost $7 trillion. I'm happy to report to you that little Georgie Gordon didn't lose any money because of irrational exuberance in the stock market bubble of the 1990s. I didn't put a dollar in, I never took a dollar out, and I never lost a dollar in the process. And whatever money I would have invested, I've still got. And I've probably still got that in spades.
Now, people like Ed Beltran are not businessmen. He was an industrial worker, worked for Lucent Technology. He was in personnel. I would assume that he's got a degree from college. But college people, people with degrees from college are not businessmen. People from college are employees. They are bond servants. They are trained bond servants. They are taught and trained that they should go to work for a big corporation and that they should work there. And if they do their job and if they're good boys and girls, they will get this retirement. It's a security package. It's a security blanket. It has nothing to do with opportunity. Businessmen are concerned with opportunity, not security. Employees are concerned with security, not opportunity. Opportunity is something that's beyond their grasp, beyond their scope. And I can tell you that with certitude because the man's working for $7.50 an hour. There is not a Jew on planet Earth that would work for $7.50 an hour. And if there is, I'd like to meet him. Only a retarded, handicapped, mentally deficient Jew would work for wages. Now, Jews are businessmen. Chinese people here in the United States are businessmen. If a Chinaman had $1,000 in his pocket, he would go out and use that $1,000 to buy, sell, and trade with, and he would make more than $7.50 an hour. Any Jew that had $1,000 in his pocket would go out and buy, sell, and trade, and he would make more than $7.50 an hour. There isn't a businessman anywhere that had $1,000 in his pocket wouldn't go out and buy, sell, and trade with the $1,000 rather than work for $7.50 an hour. A man 59 years old working for $7.50 an hour can't get a job anywhere else that pays more money. So he is not a businessman and he cannot make money buying, selling, and trading. Now here's a guy that's getting $4,467 a month. Surely he could take $1,000 out of that in 1 month and then use that $1,000 to make $1,000 a month from then on buying, selling, and trading. But this guy would rather work for wages and complain about, gee, look what happened to me. Now boys and girls, if everybody could retire on $4,467 a month after working for 30 years in his occupation. Can you picture this? You got 275 million Americans out here, and all 275 million of us want to retire on $4,467 a month forever after we have worked 30 years for some company. Is that possible? It is a mathematical impossibility. You see, I can never retire on or receive more than I produce myself. And if I do, then I have to be living off of somebody else. And if I'm living off of somebody else, then that somebody else has less than I do. So if we're all going to live on $4,467 a month for the rest of our lives, then during our working careers, we had to have made an excess of $4,467 a month that we're going to retire on for the last 20 or 25 years of our lives. And that is a mathematical impossibility. And that's just the way life is. So if you're the chief executive officer of Disney and you retire on a $200 million retirement package, you're just one out of millions and millions and millions of people who won the lottery. That's all that boils down to. Now, there are a few guys out there that go to the Harvard Business School, come out, go to work for a big corporation like Jack Welch, and retire with a multi-million dollar retirement package. But as I pointed out to you last time, these boys get paid those enormous sums of money because of their productivity, not the number of gallons of sweat that poured out of their veins or the number of years they put in at the company or the number of hours they put in on the job. They get paid for the number of bales that they put in the barn. And after all, that's what business and entrepreneurial business is all about. It's how many bales can you put in the barn. Now, I want to work until I die, and I hope that the day I die, I will be cutting wood in the woods, or I will be digging post holes and building fence, or I will be sitting at this microphone making another radio program, that I will be sharing something with somebody. I will be producing something. I will be productive. Because productivity is where life is. Productivity is what life is all about, not consumption. Everybody consumes, but not everybody produces. You know, there are people out there, boys and girls, that produce nothing and consume much. We call them soldiers in the army and welfare recipients. And when you go on retirement, you become a welfare recipient. Somebody else has to feed, clothe, and house you. That $4,467 a month that comes into this fellow, Ed Beltran, is being produced by somebody else and then paid over to him. And it's a hell of a neat program. It's called a Ponzi scheme. And Americans have bought into this Ponzi scheme called Social Security. Social Security is insolvent. And they bought into a Ponzi scheme called pension programs. And the pension programs are either insolvent, going insolvent, or will go insolvent shortly. In fact, the entire world economy is going insolvent. And last time we broke with a story that is entitled Moving to Center Stage by Jim Poplava. It's called Stormwatch Update, June 4th, 2004. I mean, it's been around for a while. It's over a year old. Poplava put this out, and it's entitled, his webpage is entitled financialsense.com. I like to read this guy's material because he's always got a good story to tell. So we're telling a story, and when we broke off last time, we finished with the China syndrome. China syndrome. Do you remember that? We were talking about the ships. Many of the ships stand idle in Chinese ports. They're waiting for as long as 3 weeks to unload. And as a result of China's voracious appetite for commodities, bulk freight costs have doubled in the last year, and shipyards in Japan and Korea have orders well into 2007. Last year, orders for new ships more than doubled to 1,600 ships. Boys and girls, we got 1,600 ships being built to supply the world's voracious demand for commodities. Now, there's a global population demand. The population has nearly doubled from 3 to 6 billion people over the last 30 years. Population is growing at the rate of 100 million people a year. This growth in population is fueling an expansion in economies worldwide and a consumption of commodities worldwide that threatens the very existence of humankind. I mean, our problem, boys and girls, is not going to be retirement and pensions in the next 20 or 30 years. It's going to be, do you have enough to eat? Do you have a roof over your head? Are you going to survive till tomorrow? So I selected about 10 contrarians. Remember, I mentioned to you last time, unemployment's at 5%. God, that's wonderful. Inflation's at 4.3%. That doesn't seem to be so bad. Our economy is growing at 3.4%. Wow. Housing prices are strong nationwide. The stock market's over 10,000, and I'm working. And everything seems to be okay. So what seems to be the problem? So I selected 10 contrarians like Bill Bonner, Franklin Sanders, Richard Gotti, Bill Buckler, Bob Chapman, Jim Jubak, Liz Pullman, John Malden, and Jim Poplava of the financialsense.com. We're going to start with Jim. Now let's pay attention to what Jim says. He said, demand for commodities is global and it is structural. Let me repeat that. Demand for commodities, food, clothing, and shelter, aluminum, steel, and cement is global and it is structural. Boys and girls, it is there, and it isn't going to go away. You got 6.5 billion people that you got to feed every day. Now, that's a structural problem. A drought is cyclical. It's here today and gone tomorrow or 5 or 10 years from now. That drought out in the West will go away at some point in time. But the population's growth is structural, and the demand for commodities is structural, and it is growing exponentially. It is growing 1, 2, 4, 8, 16. Boys and girls, it is unsustainable. And as a result of that, there is coming a great dying out. This happens in populations all over. For instance, you go out to the West and you'll see that the jackrabbits will multiply. And as the jackrabbits multiply, they eat more and more feed. At some point in time, they will run out of feed and the population will collapse. Cattle do that. Animals do that in their habitat. Disease comes in and gets them. Predators comes in and gets them. Or they just simply starve to death. But it doesn't kill all of them. It doesn't kill every jackrabbit. It doesn't kill every coyote. It doesn't kill every goat or sheep. There are always a few that do survive. I'm not suggesting that the world is going to collapse and that there will be no more people left. There's going to be more people. People are going to survive. But not all of them. Not all of them. We have a structural problem here. And this structural problem is going to be resolved. So the powers that be believe that what we need to do is to resolve this population program with a structured, intelligent population reduction program. They call it Global 2000, the New World Order. They are planning to reduce the Earth's population over the next 50 years by 90%. And if you think about it, it needs to be done. The only question to be decided is, who's going to do it and how? Who and how? Should it be done by the God of our world, the creation, the God of creation, Abraham, the God of Abraham, or should it be done by George Bush and the Committee of 300? Should it be done in a phased program over 50 or 60 years, or should it be a population collapse, which is described in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28? How is it going to occur, and how is it going to affect you? And as we're discussing this week, how is it going to affect your pension, and how is it going to affect your retirement program? Well, demand for commodities is global, and it is structural. A population of 6.4 billion people growing by 100 million people a year is something that goes beyond the debate of inflation or deflation. A recession, depression, wide-scale debt default, or a stock market crash doesn't eliminate the daily dietary and energy needs of 6.4 billion people. And as far as the thought of a recession or stock market crash eliminating the energy crunch, think again. A 1,250-pound steer requires an investment of 283 gallons of oil. Let me repeat that. A 1,250-pound steer requires an investment of 283 gallons of oil. And this includes the fertilizer to grow the corn that feeds the steer, all the way to the diesel that powers the machinery that runs the farm. Water, energy, and food are basic necessities. Those are not luxury goods that can be bought with discretionary income. Economists and analysts need to distinguish between what does and what goes into the weekly grocery basket versus a discretionary decision to eat out at McDonald's. For almost the entire 20th century, food production outpaced population growth. Grain, which is the staple diet of the majority of the world's population, is now experiencing a production decline. Did you get that, boys and girls? Grain, which is the staple diet of the majority of the world's population, is now experiencing a production decline. Grain harvests for the past 5 years have leveled off, and while the world's population continues to grow, numerous reasons are given for the fall-off from the loss of arable land, freshwater shortages, and urbanization to a change in the weather. A growing population, growing urbanization, and industrialization are all part of the reason why commodity prices are rising after a multi-decade slumber. After hitting today's close of 273.68, it is up 49%. Now let's take a look at this again. After hitting a low in October of 2001 at 183.52, the CRB index has risen to today's close of 273.66. It's up 49% over the last few years, and individual commodities such as oil and silver have risen even more. Oil prices have doubled, and until its recent pullback, so has silver. Since January of this year, the CRB, the index, has risen from 255 to 273, a gain of 7%, and this compares to losses in the stock and bond markets this year. Now, while economists and analysts dismiss the higher costs of food and energy, consumers have no such luxury. Their monthly budgets are under duress, forcing many consumers to finance monthly living expenses through credit card debt or cash out financings from their homes. Now, boys and girls, if you have a credit card debt, or if you have cashed out some of your equity from your home, then your income is under duress. In fact, if you have credit cards and you have a debt on your house, your income is under duress. You should have a house that's free and clear, and you should have a source of income, or the equivalent thereto in property, which is independent from the economy. And if you're dependent upon the economy for your livelihood, I mean, if you go to work and punch clock every day, or you work for somebody else, just like our friend here, what was his name again? Our friend over here, Beltran. Bob Beltran. Working for $7.50 now to make ends meet. Well, Beltran over here is dependent upon his job. He's dependent upon his retirement. He is not independent in his sources of livelihood. He is totally dependent upon Lucent Technology, Social Security, and his employer. That's not independence. That's dependence. Now, if you're one of those that's involved in dependence, then you should pay attention to this series of programs and be thinking about what should I be doing so that I can get off of the dependence treadmill and become independent and have a source of income, a source of food, clothing, and shelter that's independent from Social Security, independent from government, independent from technology or business or industry, and that I can produce of and by myself. That's why I said to you earlier in the program, I said, I pray to God every day that I'm never cursed with the curse of retirement. Because when that day occurs, I will become dependent upon somebody to provide my living. And when the day comes that somebody else is providing my living, the day may come when that somebody decides not to provide my living any longer. And we saw that with Ed Beltran. And we found out they just cut off his father-in-law's death benefit. And in the case of Beltran, they just cut off his health benefits. And boys and girls, they can just cut off his retirement altogether. And his employment can just terminate his employment altogether. The man is totally dependent. Now, albeit, his dependence produces $53,000 a year in income, which is above the median income. I mean, the guy is really living the life of Riley. Most Americans, more than half, would just love to be in Mr. Beltran's position, making $53,604 a year on retirement check coming in, for crying out loud, in addition to his $7.50 an hour. I pray to God that that never happens to me, that I'm never dependent upon somebody else for a retirement check or a paycheck. Now, of course, most Americans want jobs, jobs, jobs. We've been sold this concept of employment. Well, employment is simply a modern word for a servant, a bond servant. It's a term that we don't like to use because we don't like the word slave or bond servant. And so it's kind of like an employee. You know, we don't want to be an employee. We want to be a sanitation engineer, commonly known as a garbage man. Well, you don't want the name garbage man, so you want to be called a sanitation engineer. Boys and girls, semantics doesn't change the fact any. You know, I used to drive truck and I was a truck driver. I enjoyed every trip. I had a great time. I was an independent. I owned my company and drove my own company truck. I've often said I don't want to ride the front of the bus. I want to own the bus and drive the damn thing. And I did. But if you're driving a truck for somebody else, then you're dependent upon somebody else for your livelihood, your food, your clothing, and your shelter. Those are the three basic necessities of life. And if somebody else is providing those for you, that same guy that's providing it for you can take it away from you. Well, that's not going to be a very pleasant place to be. Now, while economists and analysts dismiss the higher cost of food and energy, consumers have no such luxury. Their monthly budgets are under duress, forcing many consumers to finance monthly living expenses through credit card debt or cash out financings from their homes. Boys and girls, people that are cashing out their equity in their homes don't own them. And when you lose your job and you can't make your payments, you become homeless. If you've got credit card debt and you're unable to sustain the payments, they're going to cut off your credit. If you can't make ends meet today without credit cards, how in the hell are you going to make ends meet tomorrow without a job and without credit cards? Now, that's a wild new concept, isn't it? If you can't make ends meet today with a job and debt and credit cards, how in the hell are you going to make ends meet tomorrow without a job and without any credit cards? I say it's time to wake up and smell the coffee, don't you? Hang on. Let me give you a reminder here, and we'll be back with more. On this thing of retirement at risk. Is your retirement at risk? Right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in both the United States and around the world on the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, let's go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archive. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, history, health, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, with that out of the way, let's take a look some more here of Jim Puplava. If you'd like to get a copy of this, you can probably get it off the webpage at www.financialsense.com. That's www.financialsense, that's all one word, .com, Jim Puplava. He says, then there's the energy issues. You know, energy prices are also acting as an additional tax on the economy. Gas prices seem to go up every week. And up until recently, occasional energy spikes have been looked upon as a nuisance, a temporary problem that has to be endured until more supply is brought online. I don't believe that this time the problems are temporary. The real problem is depletion, a concept that very few on Wall Street understand. While markets appear hopeful that Saudi Arabia's increased output will soon reach the market, it will be too late for this summer's driving season. And as consumers, we will have to grin and bear the higher costs of getting to and from work or a summer holiday. If fuel costs don't relent in their price rise soon, travel, whether it is for business or for pleasure, may soon become a luxury. In addition to featuring nightly complaints from consumers, our local news station now features stories of families limiting their driving and shopping due to higher fuel costs. In my own family, two of my sons are actually considering hybrid cars rather than the hot rod cars that their peers drive. And the local news station, in addition to featuring nightly complaints from consumers, now features stories of families limiting their driving and shopping due to these higher fuel costs. Now, the United States has an overconsumption of oil, gas, and power. And I sometimes wonder why the telltale signs of an impending energy crunch are ignored. The first energy crisis of this new century began appropriately in California, the center of the high-tech revolution. Granola, Sprouts, the land of the SUV, urban sprawl, Hollywood make-believe, the gnat catcher, the coastal sagebrush, and the growing environmental movement. California's energy crisis was quickly blamed on the power companies and a misguided utility deregulation program. Well, as it turned out, our crisis was solved by favorable weather. However, the energy problems of the state still remain. And California has built very few power plants given the size of its population, now 31 million. We must now import power into the state. We have not built any new refineries in California for more than 3 decades, and yet our environmental fuel standards for gasoline are so special that only California refineries can produce it. If we run short on gasoline, we cannot turn to other states for gas like we can for electric power. That's because there's no uniform environmental standard for clean-burning gasoline. Instead, there's a maze of different environmental fuel standards mandated by different states and municipalities, resulting in a Heinz 57 mix of environmental fuels across the country. If there are shortages in one region of the country, they cannot be met by surpluses from somewhere else. Our environmental laws have become a hodgepodge of different rules and regulations with no consistency or logic. Even then, the story of energy goes well beyond the traditional conflicts between industry and environmentalists. Americans are the biggest consumers of energy in the world, with 5% of the world's population burning 25% of the world's oil. We are the least energy literate people on Earth. We love our technology, but we have absolutely no idea what it takes to power it or where that power comes from. The gas that we burn in our SUVs, motorhomes, jet skis, motorcycles, or powerboats probably came from somewhere other than the United States. Our energy security is based on aircraft carriers, nuclear submarines, and our Marines. This is a shallow security blanket. In a speech given a few years ago at the Royal United Services Institute in London, Robert McFarlane, who was the former National Security Advisor to President Ronald Reagan, gave a surprise message. According to McFarlane, increasing America's energy security will be achieved not by building and deploying more aircraft carriers and tanks in the Persian Gulf, but by increasing energy efficiency and automobile fuel economy at home. 3/4 of every barrel of oil consumed in the United States goes to transportation. That's 3/4 of every barrel. 75% of all of the oil consumed in this country goes to our transportation. Energy is a problem of where and how much. And the problem for the United States and other Western powers as well is that the vast majority of the world's oil resides in the Middle East and the Caspian Sea states. 5 nations in the Persian Gulf and 2 countries in particular, Saudi Arabia and Iraq, are sitting on the mother load of oil. And as oil prices close in at $60 a barrel, Western powers are asking, if not pleading, with Saudi Arabia and OPEC to increase output. In reality, when we ask OPEC to increase output, that falls mainly on the Saudis, who have the only real spare capacity, the only real ability to increase production. Iraq has that ability, but it's a geopolitical basket case. Now, in its June issue, the National Geographic magazine cover story is titled The End of Cheap Oil. Tom Appenzeller's article featured a geographical map, a geological map of the world, detailing where the oil is and how much is left. The most striking aspect of the map is how little oil is left outside the Middle East besides Venezuela and Russia. The largest blocks of oil are to be found in Saudi Arabia, 261 billion barrels, Iran, 126 billion barrels, Iraq, 116 billion, Kuwait, 99 billion, the United Arab Emirates, 98 billion, and by contrast, the United States has only 23 billion barrels of oil left in our entire national reserve. The big hope in North America is Canada's tar sands, which contain 174 billion barrels of unconventional oil. Shell Oil, one of the big three operators of the tar sands project, is producing 600,000 barrels of oil a day. The oil is more expensive to produce, requiring 2 tons of sand for each barrel of oil that is produced from the tar sands. But optimists are hopeful that within the next decade, production could rise to 2 million barrels a day. Yet outside the tar sands, which have come on stream with technology and cost savings, there has been no major discovery of oil in the past 3 decades. The North Sea and the Prudhoe Bay oil deposits were discovered decades ago. And since the year 2000, the rate of new discoveries has fallen dramatically. According to the 2004 edition of Petroleum Review, there were only 13 discoveries of 500 million barrels in 2000, only 6 discoveries in 2001, and just 2 discoveries in 2002. In 2003, there wasn't a single discovery of over 500 million barrels. The latest large discovery is British Petroleum's Thunder Horse, which covers a 54-mile stretch in the Gulf of Mexico. And to get at the 1 billion barrels of oil, British Petroleum has had to drill 17,000 feet below the seafloor. In a recent publication to shareholders, ExxonMobil's Exploration Division President, John Thompson, told shareholders that we estimate the world oil and gas production from existing fields is declining at an average rate of 4-6% a year. To meet this projected demand, the industry will have to add 100 million oil equivalent barrels a day of new production. Now that translates to finding, developing, and producing new oil and gas equal to 8 out of every 10 barrels of oil produced today. And it is one reason why the major oil companies have consolidated. One of very few options left for increasing reserves is to go out and buy those reserves from another oil company. The other route is through the negotiating table. So if you're an ExxonMobil or a Chevron, Texaco, or BP, the new strategy to increase reserves is to negotiate for them, according to a recent Wall Street Journal article. The age of elephant strikes are now over. There has been just one great find in the past 30 years. The 1999 discovery of Kashagan, a field off Kazakhstan in the Caspian Sea. The simple fact is that most of the world's oil reserves remain in the hands of state-owned oil companies in the Middle East. And oil consumption is outpacing the industry's ability to find and replace its production and the loss of reserves. All of the majors have deal teams, and these teams are just as likely to be made up of diplomats as they are to be made up of geologists. Now, global competition for these declining reserves. By January of this year, the United States had only 13 days worth of oil held in reserve, with all of the nation's refineries running at full capacity. Industrial states from the United States to Japan are rushing to increase their oil stockpiles. Japan, which must compete with China for Russian oil and pipelines, is urging Asian nations to build up their oil reserves. Japan has stockpiled more than 160 days of the oil that it uses. China, the world's second largest consumer of oil, has only 21 days supply on hand. Oil security will become the focal point at a June meeting in Manila, and Western nations are scrambling to increase their strategic stockpiles of oil almost as a premonition of something that lies directly ahead. And it is rumored that some nations have gone so far as to print up rationing tickets for fuel. Do you get that, boys and girls? Ration cards. Perhaps it is the change in terrorist activity. Recent attacks have centered on the oil industry by targeting oil facilities, terminals, and oil workers. What has been buried in the back pages of our newspapers is the subtle shift by governments to start stockpiling reserves. In The New Great Game, author Lutz Cleverman describes the Middle East as the world's largest gas station where madmen go around constantly lighting matches. Cleverman's book, required reading in my opinion, goes on to describe the 21st century version of The Great Game. The Great Game was immortalized by Rudyard Kipling's novel Kim. Whereas the 19th century version involved the clash of imperial ambitions between Tsarist Russia and Great Britain, today's game is the struggle to control the world's remaining energy reserves. It pits the United States against the resource ambitions of Russia, China, and Iran. Statesmen and generals played the 19th century game. Statesmen and generals are still playing this game today, but they are joined now by geologists, oil barons, and warlords. It is now a high-stakes game for the world's most valuable resource, oil. And resource wars and energy security are now in our future. The industrialized world runs on oil, and whether we like it or not, there's no new energy source on the horizon to replace it. The Middle East and the Caspian Sea have become the new battleground of the 21st century. As new sources of energy become scarcer to find and the price of oil escalates throughout this decade and the next, nations will find themselves in conflict with each other over natural resources from oil and natural gas to water and arable land. And over the last decade, we have seen resource wars fought in Angola, Chechnya, Iraq, and Kuwait. And when resources are plentiful, market mechanisms function as an arbiter of price. When scarcity arises, armed conflict has the final say. Armed conflict is the final arbiter. In the last century, Germany went to war to gain access to territory and energy resources. Japan pursued a similar policy in China and Mongolia. Right now, energy security for the United States entails carrier battle groups, Marines, and soldiers throughout the Middle East, including Iraq. In order to secure access to foreign oil, China is pursuing relations with terrorist states like Iran. A recent congressional study on economic security reports that China's foreign policy is now like the United States, driven by access to energy and strategic raw materials. China provides technology and weapons to Iran, Syria, and Jordan. And until recently, Iraq, in exchange for access to oil, China has been moving troops into the Sudan in order to secure its foreign oil sources. Now, when you have a world economy that runs on a single fuel source, energy security becomes paramount. However, energy security entails more than protecting the sea lanes or oil terminals. It also involves ensuring access to supplies to meet immediate demands of a growing economy. This means having access to the necessary fuels needed to power transportation, as well as the fuel needed to run power plants that produce electricity. Author Paul Roberts, in his book, The End of Oil, defines energy security as this. He said, energy security goes well beyond mere questions of supply. No matter how much oil or gas we can find, this supply is worthless unless we have in place the physical infrastructure, the political stability, and the financial and technological resources to get it to those who need it, criteria that are growing more difficult to meet day by day. Energy infrastructure and alternatives behind the times. Regarding the issues of energy security, the United States has fallen far behind, and we have built no new refineries in this country over the past three decades. And the last new refinery was built in the mid-1970s. We have over 50 different varieties of gasoline, making it difficult to supply areas that are experiencing peak demand. As a result of allowing our energy infrastructure to go into decline, we now must import more of our gasoline from places like Venezuela. Even then, new EPA standards will make it more difficult to import foreign gasoline. If a crisis erupts this summer, there are very few alternatives. Problems with our energy infrastructure go beyond refineries. We haven't built enough power plants in this country to keep up with the demand for electricity. The power plants that we are building run on natural gas. It is a fuel that is in short supply also here in the United States, and it must be imported. Natural gas has the same problem as oil. Natural gas has become the fuel of choice by governments in the United States and in Europe. However, like oil, the largest deposits of natural gas lie in the massive gas fields in Iran, Qatar, Turkmenistan, and Russia. This presents a logistics problem since the largest gas suppliers are located far from the biggest markets, such as the United States and in China. For the United States, it will mean building new liquid natural gas or liquefied natural gas terminals, LNG. Is far more expensive to handle and transport and creates its own unique security issues. Many states and cities have been opposed to building these LNG terminals because of environmental opposition and related security issues. In San Diego, our local utility has found it easier to build its next gas-powered plant in Mexico. The Baja Peninsula is becoming a new energy hub for gas-powered plants and liquid or liquefied natural gas terminals that will power them. All of the major energy companies from Shell to Conoco are moving and investing in that region. ConocoPhillips is building 5 regasification terminals in Baja California. While natural gas may be the preferred fuel of choice, it remains in short supply in North America. And North America burns nearly one-third of the world's natural gas and yet has less than 2% of the world's natural gas deposits. The United States is making a policy decision to switch to natural gas. The problem with this policy is that we have very little of this natural gas in our own inventories. We're just now waking up to the fact that the natural gas that we desire will have to be procured mainly from the Middle East, leaving the United States in the same precarious position as it finds itself with oil, dependent upon foreign sources. And time is running out. What is clear from reviewing the energy markets is the reality that there is no silver bullet when it comes to energy. If the facts are examined, it is clear that unless we begin to act now to conserve energy and begin looking at alternative energy sources, we will indeed be staring at the perfect storm. And we need to start having a rational debate regarding energy in this country, or else we'll be forced to deal with this issue in a crisis mode. Our politicians need to free themselves from special interest groups, whether power companies or environmentalists. Facts need to be discussed and disclosed. Most Americans are unaware that oil discovery in the U.S. peaked in 1930. U.S. oil discovery peaked in 1930, and that it was followed 40 years later by peak production in 1970. Global discovery of oil peaked during the 1960s, and since the early 80s, the world has been running a net deficit in oil that keeps getting bigger every year. Oil geologists believe oil production will peak sometime within this decade, and for OPEC sometime in the next decade. Peak oil doesn't, or production doesn't mean that we've run out of oil. It means that there will simply be less of it. For economies that are built on assumptions of continuous economic growth, this will mean recessions or even worse, depressions. The brownouts, power outs, and price spikes over the last few years are warning signs of things to come. The jump in natural gas prices over the last few years is already starting to take its toll on whole industries, from chemical manufacturers to producers of fertilizer. By early 2003, fully 25% of United States fertilizer factories had been shut down. companies began to shift production overseas where there was access to feedstock. In Argentina recently, industrial production suffered its biggest decline in 3 years, halting 6 months of production as natural gas shortages forced manufacturers to cut output. One brickmaker, Finelli S.A., had to halt production for 4 days because it had no gas to power its furnaces. The shortage of gas in the country came as a result of government price controls, which stopped investment in expanding gas supplies. The country now faces decisions on whether to cut gas supply to its biggest industrial users or to cut gas to households during the winter months. This is no way to grow an economy. The problems faced in Argentina may also be coming home to roost in the United States. The August 2003 blackout affected over 50 million homes and businesses in the United States and Canada. And the problem stems from generation capacity, which has not kept up growth in the nation's transmission infrastructure. In China, blackouts and brownouts are becoming routine. These kinds of problems are now starting to surface here in the United States and globally in Europe and in South America. Now, boys and girls, this is a report from Jim Puplava. You can get this report from Financial Sense online, Moving to Center Stage, first published June 4th, 2004. It's called Storm Watch Update. The title again, Moving to Center Stage, Storm Watch Update, from www.financialsense.com. Our subject, is your retirement at risk? Boys and girls, it's more than just your retirement that's at risk. It's your life that's at risk. I'm going to show you from a plethora of contrarian economists, Bill Bonner, Franklin Sanders, Dick Doty, Bill Buckler, Bob Chapman, and others. We're facing a global economic problem, a monumental tidal wave that is going to sweep over the world. When? I don't know. I'm not a prophet, but it's coming. Get ready. Well, we're about out of time. We'll have to take it up right here next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Remember, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.